Glowing balls of energy appear out of nowhere, only to vanish a few seconds later. Ball lightning is strange, rare, and unexplained. In this episode, we explore the mystery, prod at the boundary between folklore and science, and ask how, when evidence is so scarce, how can we figure out what is true? You're listening to I Heart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. "It was following me," she said. And whatever it was, I could tell that it was aware. We were sitting on the porch of an old farmhouse in a tiny, remote village in Vermont. Outside, summer twilight was descending in the fields. It was the perfect setting for a ghost story. And our host, Edie Bickle, a gregarious old woman with twinkling eyes, was the perfect person to tell one. I don't remember how the story came up, but I do remember the rapt attention on everyone's faces. "Wait, what was following you?" someone asked. "I don't know what it was," Edie said. "I was out in the fields. I was maybe 14 and alone, except for the cows. There was a storm coming across the field. Floating over the grass was this orb. I didn't see where it came from. It was glowing. And like I said, it was following me. And I could tell that it knew I was there." "Were you afraid?" Edie shook her head. "I knew it didn't mean me any harm." "How long did it follow you?" "Only a minute or so." "Where did it go?" "I don't know," Edie shrugged. "It was there for a moment, and then it was gone." My friends and I looked at each other, and I felt the tickle of goosebumps on my arms. Or how about this? In March of 1963, Roger Jennison, an English radio astronomer, was on a late-night flight from New York to Washington, D.C., when the plane flew into an electrical storm. 5 minutes after midnight, there was a bright flash of lightning and a loud peal of thunder, and then, Jameson would report, he saw something truly extraordinary. A glowing sphere, about the size of a soccer ball, emerged from the pilot's cabin and floated down the aisle, passing right next to him before it disappeared. Or how about this? 1936 report from a Mr. Morris of Dorston, England. "During a thunderstorm, I saw a large red-hot ball come down from the sky. It struck our house, cut the telephone wires, burnt the window frame, and then buried itself in a tub of water which was underneath. The water boiled for some minutes afterwards, but when it was cool enough for me to search, I could find nothing in it. Fireballs? Luminous orbs? Glowing spheres? What the heck is going on?" These three stories are just a sampling of similar reports of encounters with strange, short-lived, floating, glowing balls of something. The accounts range back over centuries, and there are thousands of them. The particulars of the accounts differ, but they all share several things in common. The apparitions are almost always spherical. They never get much bigger than a beach ball. They usually last between 10 and 30 seconds. They move, often erratically, and usually at about the same speed that a person might walk. And they occur during electrical storms, but usually not immediately near a lightning strike. Some observers report a hissing or crackling sound. Sometimes they explode, damaging ships or buildings or sometimes even people. Sometimes they just disappear. Sometimes they smell like sulfur or ozone. And most intriguing to me, some observers report that they pass right through solid walls. How frickin' cool. People interested in these strange reports have given the phenomenon a name. They call it ball lightning. But a label, however badass it sounds, is not an explanation. So, I want to know, what the heck is going on? The short answer is that we don't know. Nobody knows. But that doesn't mean people aren't trying to explain them. Candidate ideas include maybe lightning ionizes air molecules and turns them into a plasma. Basically, the air becomes a flame without a fire. Or maybe that happens to dirt that's vaporized by a lightning strike. Or maybe there's charged particles which are held in place by a strangely stable electromagnetic field. Or maybe they're caused by exotic states of matter like Rydberg particles, or maybe it's an optical illusion, like the kind of thing that happens when you get an afterimage from a bright flash that stays in your vision even after the light source is no longer glowing. It could be a misinterpretation of some phenomenon we already know about but just aren't recognizing. Or it could even be a hallucination. Epileptic seizures in the occipital lobe produce similar experiences where people see bright lights. One 2008 study demonstrated that the changing magnetic fields of electrical storms could induce such seizures. Because, after all, our brains operate with electrical signals. Whatever the reason, what makes all of this especially cool and mysterious is that ball lightning shouldn't exist. It shouldn't be lightning, anyway. It lasts too long to be an electrical discharge. And most of the other ideas about being some kind of plasma shouldn't work either. I mean, plasmas aren't usually stable, unless there's a whole lot of energy. And even if they are stable, why would they keep this ball shape if they're not contained by something? And whether you followed all that scientific name-dropping or not, you can still appreciate that the idea that there are glowing, floating soccer balls of colored light hanging out in lightning storms is a truly extraordinary claim. Should we take it seriously? Look, if all you want is a cool story to tell around the campfire, you don't have to take it seriously. There's a ton of bizarre reports of people's experiences with ball lightning. So read up online, hold that flashlight under your chin, and, you know, just rock on with your bad self. But if you're anything like me, you just can't quite get the questions that come up out of your head. Wait, do these orbs really exist? If so, then what the f*** are they? I want to know the truth. Now, you might just discount the idea because it's weird. But there is no weirdness screening for reality. Weird things frequently turn out to be true. The Earth is round, even though it looks flat from here. It's moving, even though it doesn't feel that way. And it really is mind-bogglingly old. The continents move. Black holes are a thing. In a faraway land, there really is an egg-laying beaver with a duck bill and a venomous spike on its hind foot. Consider, for example, another storm phenomenon. For a long time, people reported these towering flashes of reddish light that exploded upward out of storm clouds like something from an Avengers movie or a portal to the demon realms. These sprites, as people called them, were so exceedingly rare that people doubted their existence, and all we had were occasional eyewitness accounts, until some were captured accidentally in video footage in 1989. And since then, thousands of sprites have been photographed from the ground, from airplanes, even from space. We still don't know what they are, but nobody really doubts anymore that they are there. On the other hand, as Richard Feynman reminded us, the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. Smart, rationally minded people have convinced themselves that vampires are real, that their neighbors were witches, that the way to cure diseases was to make patients bleed, and that insects could spontaneously form from rotting flesh. And it is especially easy to fool ourselves with something like ball lightning because we have so little evidence to challenge our credulity. If ball lightning exists, it is incredibly rare. So far, there's no credible pictures, or videos, or measurements. This means that all we have to go on are eyewitness testimonies. And unlike in a court of law, in the court of science, it is better to assume that all eyewitnesses are guilty until proven innocent. I mean, for one, people make shit up all the time. Two, even if they aren't making shit up, people exaggerate. I mean, everybody loves a good yarn, so there's strong incentive to tell a good one. And even when we're trying to be truthful, we often exaggerate unintentionally. I mean, it's not our fault. It's just part of the architecture of our brains. We are biased to remember the most dramatic parts of an event and forget the details that would make it less extraordinary. Oh, and humans are terrible at separating out observation from explanation. Our brains immediately start making up stories to explain what we see, and what we remember is often twisted and changed by the stories that we are telling ourselves. And even our memories betray us. Every time we retell events, we're not only at risk of changing the story, we're also at risk of changing the memory, because every time we draw a memory up, our brains re-encode it. It's actually more accurate to say that we don't remember events. We remember our most recent memory of those events. So where should we be on the skepticism scale? I mean, how can we be open-minded, but not so open-minded that our brain falls out? Well, when faced with extraordinary claims, the best thing to do, of course, is to test them. I mean, it'd be awesome if we could get some ball lightning in the laboratory and test our ideas about what it is. But clearly, that's not an option. I mean, we can't even get a good photo. But laboratory tests aren't the only kind of test we have at our disposal. Philosophers of science have given us some logical tests for dealing with anecdotal claims. Here's three. First, current theory. How does something stand up in light of ideas that we've already extensively tested? Most extraordinary things don't fit with what we think we already know. That's what makes them extraordinary. And today, especially, what we know reflects the results of so many tests over so much time. In light of this, if centuries of ruthless and rigorous tests conflict with a handful of eyewitness accounts, I'll err on the side of the centuries of testing. Test number two, simplicity. Or as the fancy science philosopher folks say, parsimony. That basically just means that if there are multiple explanations for something, like there are for ball lightning, in the absence of other evidence, the simplest explanations tend to be right. Suppose I'm trying to explain the origin of what seems to be a human face on the planet Mars. Given the choice between it being, one, a fortuitous coincidence of hills and shadows, or two, the product of some alien civilization that's left no obvious traces on the planet and just happened to somehow know what a human face looked like and then built a monumental image of one that they couldn't even see from the ground where they were building it. Yeah, I'll go with the coincidence for now. Test number three, not finding stuff. Yeah, I know. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Or to say it more simply, just because you don't see something, that's not proof that it isn't there. But if you've been looking for something rigorously for a long time and in a place where you should find it and you don't find it, you tend to give up after a while. You can never really be sure that it's not just hiding really well, but the longer you look, the higher the probability that the reason you're not finding it is because it's not there. When I learned about these three tests, they really reframed what I thought open-mindedness was like. We're not actually better off by endlessly giving unsubstantiated ideas the benefit of the doubt. In fact, we do better, and we are more likely to end up closer to the truth if we err on the side of skepticism. And that's why I find ball lightning so intriguing. So much more intriguing than other so-called mysteries based on eyewitness accounts like a plesiosaur in Loch Ness or alien spacecrafts at Roswell. Consider how ball lightning fares against our three tests. Test number one. Does ball lightning call current theory into question? Well, kind of. It certainly seems unlikely in light of theories about electricity and plasma, but it's also possible to see how it might fit. It's right on the edge. It challenges current theories without completely undermining them. That's the kind of thing that makes me sit forward in my chair a little bit. Test number two, parsimony. Are there simple explanations that could account for ball lightning? Well, kind of. It could be an optical illusion or an electrically induced seizure in the occipital lobe. But frankly, these explanations are just as awesomely complicated as some of the explanations put forward to explain how ball lightning might be an actual thing. So none of the explanations that we have, physical or illusory, account for the whole range of phenomena that have been reported. So that's cool. I'm sitting forward a little bit more. Okay, test number three, an absence of evidence. Have we been looking for ball lightning and not found it where we should have? Well, kind of. Some scientists actually have looked at the various ideas about where ball lightning might come from and then tried to set up the conditions that, if those ideas are right, would lead to ball lightning formation. And we haven't gotten ball lightning, but they have gotten eerily stable plasmas that might be like ball lightning. So, add to that a 2014 report from some scientists studying lightning in Tibet that they captured and made spectrographic measurements of what might have been ball lightning, and now I'm on the edge of my seat. This is the coolest place to be, right on the edge of the mystery. The usual tools of skeptical science don't quite weed it out. If ball lightning is a thing, if all of these mysterious events and strange sightings are caused by a physical phenomenon, then it's got to be a really weird phenomenon. And if we investigate something like that, we are bound to learn something new, something that just might topple old ideas and take us one step closer to understanding another piece of the world that we live in. People all over the world are captured by stories of alien visitors or past lives or homeopathic remedies or the miracles of saints. And when they are faced with scientific skepticism about these things, they often write it off as closed-minded curmudgeonry. They'll accuse skeptics of being protective of their own pet theories or being uncomfortable with the unknown. And while it may be true that plenty of scientists can be closed-minded, this isn't because of the science. The principle that I could be wrong about this is what the entire scientific enterprise is built on. That's why science is the way it is. With repeated trials and peer review, it's not built to protect theories. It's built to break them on purpose. Rather than protecting theories, science is institutionally committed to being ruthless with them. If we have confidence in evolution or germ theory, it's because some of the most brilliant people have been subjecting them to abuse for centuries, and no one, not one of them, has found a crack in the armor. So sure, maybe we make minor modifications to them now and then, but the core remains unbroken. Scientists aren't skeptical because they're uncomfortable with mystery or the unknown. As Neil deGrasse Tyson puts it, you can't be a scientist if you're uncomfortable with ignorance. That's where science lives. Scientists are skeptical because they are open to the unknown. The people who are really uncomfortable with the unknown or the mysterious or just weird stuff are the ones who immediately jump to an explanation. What's that thing in the sky? It's nothing I recognize. Must be an alien spacecraft. The willingness to sit with skepticism, to baste in the mystery without having to have an answer until you've got one that survives the best criticisms that you can hurl at it, well, that strikes me as a sign of the truly open mind. Remember what the U in UFO stands for. In my view, science doesn't have anything against the Loch Ness Monster or Sasquatch or alien visitors. I mean, it'd be totally badass if they were real. If you find Sasquatch bones in the woods or a plesiosaur washed up on the shore of a lake, I will be the first to admit that I'm wrong. But you'll have to forgive me if I'm not holding my breath. Not when so many people have looked for so long and have only found evidence that can be explained with much simpler stories. As my buddy Carl put it, there are wonders enough out there without our inventing any. So do I believe Edie Bickel's story about that glowing orb that followed her through the cow pasture? I don't know. And that's the best thing about ball lightning. Nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what causes it. We don't even know if it's a thing. And it's not like dark energy or consciousness or quantum entanglement where you need to on-ramp a bunch of knowledge just to ask the question. You can tell a third grader a story about ball lightning and they get it. They get the mystery, they get that it's weird, and they can get how we have no idea. Real or imagined, this is what ball lightning does for me. It reminds me that the mystery is just as much fun as the finding out. Hey, if you've been having fun with iHeartThis, there are three things that you can do right now to support us. Each of them will take no more than 2 minutes, and they really make a difference to my ability to keep making this podcast. So please, take a moment right now and 1, subscribe or follow on your platforms of choice, especially on YouTube. You can find links to our channel in the show notes. 2, leave a review on the app where you're listening. Tell folks what you liked. And 3, send a friend a link to an episode that you think they might dig. iHeartThis is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our website is iHeartThisPodcast.com. You can email me at ben@iHeartThisPodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.